The meaning of the word that is translated deacon. According to Young's Analytical Concordance, the Greek word translated deacon is found a total of 30 times. And that word is diakonos. And so diakonos is one of those Greek words that is so similar to the English that we can see diakonos, deacon. It's translated deacon a total of, or it's found a total of 30 times. The word is translated three different ways. It's translated deacon three times, minister 20 times, and servant seven times. And I'm not going to look at all the different passages where these could be illustrated. It is interesting that as we talk about deacon as one who is occupies a position in a church and an assigned work and everything in a church, we find that word three times. Out of the 30 times we find this word in the original, we find it translated as deacon only three times. The passages where the term is translated deacon are 1 Timothy 3, verses 8 and 12, where qualifications are given for those who are to serve as deacons. And again, I'm not going to study that in any detail because we're just primarily looking tonight at what the work of deacons is. But in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 8, deacons in like manner must be grave, not double-tongued, not given to much wine, not greedy of filthy lucre. And then in verse 12 of the same chapter, let deacons be husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own house as well. In Philippians 1 and verse 1, they are listed there along with the bishops as recognized fixtures of the church at Philippi. The letter is addressed to the bishops and deacons of the church there. So we have these three verses where the term is found. In addition, there are two verses that use a verb that means to act as a deacon. So in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 10, where he's talking about the qualifications of deacons, he says, and let these also first be proved, then let them serve as deacons. So in that situation, let them serve as deacons, the word serve as deacon is a verb itself. So I know, in a way, sometimes I start getting technical, and it's just because I love to get it just exactly right. So sometimes I go overboard. That word deacon is found as a noun three times. Twice it's found in connection with a verb. So the translation winds up with deacon five times. So maybe that will help to put it out there in the right way. So we have three verses where the noun deacon is found. And then we have two verses where the word is found in connection with the verb that means to act as deacon. There's not one word in any of these verses that we have referred to here, not one word in any of these verses about any specific work that the deacons are to do. So that raises the question, how then may we know anything about their work? So I want to address that. And this lesson is not based on just a general study of the whole subject and everything. But we are looking particularly at what the Bible indicates about the work that deacons do. So we're going to start out in examining this by looking at the term deacon itself. So you see, I want you to understand, how may we know anything about their work? Well, we start out, first of all, by looking at the term deacon itself. Elders are portrayed in the Bible as superintendents, and they lead the church as shepherds of the flock. The terms overseer and pastor used in reference to the elders show this, as well as many verses describing their work. So here we have, first of all, I'm looking at elder. We have the word elder, we have the word presbyter, we have the word pastor, we have the word overseer. All of those words refer to the same function so far as the church is concerned. And in making the point that the elders are superintendents and that they lead the church as shepherds of the flock, we look at these terms that are used to depict the elders, such as overseer. Well, when one oversees something, that means that he has the direction of it. He has the supervising of it. The idea of the pastor, that's the idea of a shepherd who has a flock. He looks after that flock and takes care of that flock. In Acts 20 and verse 28, feed the church which the Lord purchased with His own precious blood. Feed the church as a shepherd who is taking care of His sheep, of His flock. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 2, Peter writes, tend the flock of God which is among you. All right, now in those verses and in what we're reading here, we're reading verses and ideas that help us to understand what an elder is, what a presbyter is, what a pastor is. All of it is the same idea. In Hebrews 13 and verse 17, we find this statement about the work of elders. Obey them that have the rule over you. It is addressed to those whom the elders oversee. Obey them that have the rule over you. But the work of the elders here is to have the rule over you, to have the supervision. And then it goes on, and submit to them, for they watch in behalf of your souls as they that shall give account, that they may do this with joy and not with grief. So I think it's important to notice that, first of all, we have a word elder. That word elder or pastor or overseer, all of the words here have to do with one who superintends, one who leads, one who guides, and so on. Now, when we look at the word deacon and what it means, deacons are assistants. That's the basic idea in the word deacon. It is the idea of an assistant. The term itself means this, not only in the verses where the reference is to deacons of the church, but also in the verses where the word is translated as minister and servant. In every one of them, still the basic idea is an assistant. When the Bible is talking about a preacher as a minister, as it often does, using this very same word that's translated deacon, it is using the idea of an assistant. And I think some preachers need to know that, because sometimes some preachers seem to get the idea that they run everything. This is particularly true in many of the denominations. And they say, I'm a minister. Well, if you're a minister, then you don't run everything. If you are a minister, you are an assistant. That's what the word means. So whether you're a minister, whether you are a servant, whether you are a deacon, the idea is you are an assistant. You're not the superintendent. You're not the overseer. You're not the one who has the rule, and so on. The deacons, therefore, in the church, help the elders to carry out the work of the church. Now, they do not help tend. See, they do not help tend because the tending is peculiarly the work that God has given to the elders. But in the work that the elders undertake, the deacons help them to execute that work. The jobs that deacons do involve, especially the physical jobs that need to be done, but also can include work that is spiritual in nature. There is absolutely nothing to prevent a deacon from doing something that could fall into a category called spiritual. There could be teaching involved. In a minute, we're going to look at the seven men that were chosen in Acts 6. And one of those men was Stephen. When you read about Stephen, you sure don't get the idea that here is a guy who could do all kinds of physical stuff, but he had no spiritual qualities, no spiritual abilities. No, that's not true at all. So we don't want to just put a limit here and say the deacons can't do anything that's spiritual. It's all got to be the physical jobs. The jobs that are done largely behind the scenes. And they're vital to the smooth operation of a church. Now, you and I sit here, and over the months and over the years, we've had our times with the projector. We've had our times with the speaker and everything. So we sometimes say, yeah, sometimes we can see that there's a problem. Or, well, let me tell you, you just probably have no idea of the work that does go on that you don't know anything about. And if you did, and if it did not go on, you would be absolutely amazed. And I also would like to make a point that in the New Testament, remember we have three times that the noun that is used, deacon, in the sense of one who is appointed to serve a position. We have two times where the verb is used with that idea. All the rest of those times don't have to do with that kind of a deacon. So that means that the word is used many times in an informal way, and we have people here at Eastside who in an informal way are deacons. Not in the sense of being appointed such, meeting qualifications, but in the generic sense of the word as it is used often in the New Testament. Many of those 30 times it is used in the sense of one who generically is serving. And we have people who are not deacons, and yet they serve in ways that if they did not serve, you would soon see a huge difference. So there's a lot that goes on. And you know, one of the things that I really want to appeal to you about as a church is I want us to remember that we are a body, and we're not just a body, we are the body, the body of Christ. And we are to function according to the working in due measure of each several part. And we are to work in the doing of good. You know, it seems to me a weird thing that sometimes the matter of doing good can become a contest. Isn't there something jarring about the idea of doing good as a contest? So let us be grateful for the work that is done. It must not be done in a spirit of competition. What is that song we sing? It seems like there is a song we sing that is very appropriate. Of course, you know what I'm talking about. There is room in the kingdom. Remember that song? But I'm just making the point that, oh, there's a lot of work that goes on. And we need to appreciate that work. And as opportunity comes, many of us, perhaps all of us, will have occasion from time to time to do some of that work. I've mentioned to you before that I have had occasion in visiting with people, talking with people, to know the things that are done that the rest of us, maybe most of us, don't even know that they're being done. That's the way good ought to be. That is the way the doing of good ought to be. Not a matter of show, not a matter of competition. As Jesus said in the matter of doing alms, let not your right hand know what your left hand is doing. So let us be very thankful to have a body such as we have, with people that want to do good. Let us be thankful that we have men who are deacons, who put in the kind of time that it takes. And I have occasion to know of the time that is put into the work of deacons. And it is a lot of time. It's a lot of thought. And it's not only the deacon that is involved, but it is also his family. Just as with elders, let me assure you, you don't have just the elders doing their work. The elders have to be supported by their wives. If wives do not support elders in their work, they cannot do it. If deacons do not have wives to support them in their work, they cannot do it. We might even say that if preachers' wives do not support what they do, they cannot do it. So I am grateful, and I believe that our elders are grateful. And I know that as I think about what our elders do, and I have a good bit of occasion to know what they do, I've known these men very, very well. I've been in a lot of the meetings, and I know what they talk about. And I know that they meet and talk about things even when I'm not there. And I know how much the support of their wives mean to them. And so it is with the deacons. And so I appreciate the wives of our deacons. I appreciate the wives of our elders. And we need to all work to carry on the smooth operation of the church. And remember that we do good to do good. We don't do good ever to compete. We do good in order that we might carry out the work of the Lord. I think we do good for its own sake, don't we? We do good to go to heaven, but I think we also need to do good because we like to do good. Did you know that's why God does good? God does good because He likes to do good. And we need to do good because we like to do good. I want us to use an example here as we further explore the work of deacons. Though the men of Acts 6 are not referred to as deacons, and though there is considerable question about whether they would have met the qualifications of 1 Timothy 3, I believe that the example found in Acts 6 illustrates principles that are involved in the deacon's work. The reason why I raise this question, and I'm not intending to go into it into any depth, is because, for example, if you follow the work of Philip, you know, he was one of the seven. You follow the work of Philip, who when things blew up in Jerusalem, he took off, went to Samaria. Any mention of a family? Any mention of a wife? None. He leaves Samaria, takes off a fairly long way, especially walking, goes all the way down from the road that goes from Jerusalem to Gaza, preaches to the Ethiopian eunuch there. The Spirit of the Lord catches him away, and there he is going on and ultimately coming to Caesarea. So I don't see those, some of those qualities that are specified in 1 Timothy 3 as qualifications. Nevertheless, I still believe that there are things that we can see here that would give us some ideas about the way the deacons worked and what their work was. In Acts chapter 6, a problem arose concerning the daily ministration. Now, this ministration is defined in the context. And by the way, I want you to observe this. That word, the daily ministration, that word ministration itself is from diakonia. Can you guess what word diakonia is kin to? See, it is. It's kin to that word deacon. So it is from diakonia, a word that means service, something that was being done for others to help them. That's what this daily ministration was. And it's interesting that the word daily, you look up the word that's translated daily, you know what it means? It means daily. Isn't that great? That's what I often find when I look up the meaning of Greek words. I find that they mean just what the translators put down here in the English. Ministration is from diakonia, a word that means service. Secondly, it involves something in which the Grecian widows were neglected. That seems to have been conceded, and steps were taken to deal with that. It was also something that involved what the apostles called serving tables. So this gives us a little bit of an indication about what was going on. The church was under the oversight of the apostles at this time. There had been no scattering. There are no elders mentioned at all at this period of the church, nor is there any evidence that the church had scattered yet. And so everything we see, the money that is brought, where is it brought? It is laid at the apostles' feet. So I don't believe it can even be argued that the apostles were not the ones at this time who were supervising the work in the church at Jerusalem. The church was under the oversight of the collective apostles. You talk about a unique situation, wouldn't you say that was a pretty unique situation? What other time in all the history of the church would you have the collective apostles in a local church? And that was the situation that prevailed here for a while. Now the apostles recognized the problem when it was brought to them. They recognized the problem and they deemed the problem necessary to deal with. See, they did not ignore it. They did not say, well, I don't think there's anything to that. No, they treated it as if it were a serious problem. But notice this. They did not think it fit to take their time away from what their primary responsibilities were to take care of the problem. So, here are those who have the supervision of the church here in Jerusalem, having a problem brought to their attention, a need that is brought to their attention. And they deem it necessary to solve and to take care of, but they do not think that it is fit for them to take the time away from what their primary responsibilities were in order to take care of the problem. Therefore, they called the church together. They called upon the church to select men of sterling reputation, good report, men whose lives thoroughly reflected the influence, guidance of the Holy Spirit. And then they appointed these men over the work. And they were to take care of the work. And they did take care of the work. And by the way, one of the interesting things about that situation is that the names of those seven men are Grecian names. And since the murmuring had come from the Grecian Jews that their widows were being neglected in the daily ministration, then it seems that when the multitude was called together by the apostles, and the apostles said, choose you from among... Now listen, I want you to see this. The apostles did not say, we are your spiritual leaders, and you know that we are the very best of men. And being the very best of men, we're going to give you some real good suggestions here. We think it would be a good idea when you choose the men that are to do this. If you chose them from among the Grecians, that'd be a good gesture. The apostles didn't have to say that. And without the apostles having to say that, the church in Jerusalem did it out of their own hearts. Out of their own inclinations, out of the goodness of their own hearts, these were a people who wanted to solve the problem. When you have a church where the people want to solve problems, problems will be solved. When you have a church where people want to create problems, you will have a church that has nothing but problems. And the difference is an attitude. I'll tell you another difference. Attitude. And yet a third difference. Attitude. But this church said, look, if we choose seven Hebrew men and say we're going to put them over this, then that's going to leave this whole thing still up where we're susceptible to being criticized because we're not doing it right. So it appears to me that what they did was they said, listen, since the complaint has come from the Grecian Jews, we're going to choose Grecian Jews and put them over this business, and that will do everything we can to guarantee that those that are having the problem will see to it that the problem is met. And that is a terrific attitude on the part of the multitude. So, you know, the apostles did not seem to indicate that there was some really wicked, underhanded, mean stuff going on here. But it's just that when you've got, you know how many members they had in Jerusalem? At the end of the day of Pentecost, they had 3,000. By chapter 5, I think it was chapter 4, the number of the men had come to be 5,000. And then in chapter 6, we learn that a great company of the priests were obedient to the faith. So, I don't see anything in the context to indicate that somebody felt like there was evil villainy at work here. It's just hard to make sure that everything is done and that stuff does not drop through the cracks and so on. And so I think that what had happened was that's what had happened. There were some oversights, some things that were not being properly seen after. And so I commend, and I'm sure, don't they appreciate this? I commend the apostles for being the kind of men who said, there is a problem here. We're going to have to address it. I commend the multitude for being the kind of multitude they were. And I certainly commend those 7 men that were chosen. Now, my brothers and sisters, when you look at the story that is Acts 6, you've got a wonderful, wonderful pattern for the functioning of the church and for the way that work is done. And so they selected these men and they put them into this position and appointed these men over that work, and they did it. Now notice that the work these men did were not random jobs. They were not random jobs, but they were tasks directly involved in doing the work the apostles deemed necessary. The deacons were not appointed and told, go out and find something to do. These men were given jobs and sent out to do the specific jobs that had been given. The elders have spent hours... hours and hours. I know I would have no idea how many hours they have spent trying to cover everything, every base, to try to make sure that everything is covered. To make sure that there aren't any of those cracks that something's going to fall through. But, you know, on the other hand, we need to be careful that we are not standing around trying to watch and find stuff that falls through the cracks. Aha! I found something you forgot. How does that sound? I don't think that sounds very good. What we need to do is to recognize that godly men have spent hours working with other godly men to try to see to it that the Lord's work is going to be done. And we, the congregation that chose the men, put their names up, both as elders, and then later in the case of the deacons, we have done that with the desire that the Lord's work be done. So as we look at this fact right here, so it must be with the deacons among us as well. And as I say, the elders have done much work in assigning different tasks to various deacons to be sure that no work is neglected. But now there's something else that I need to point out. Throughout the years, there's been a tendency, although I will say that I haven't seen that problem here, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I think it needs to be said. In a lot of places, the idea is that we don't need to do any personal work, personal evangelism, teaching classes. We don't need to do that because we have hired a preacher. And we all know that merely having a preacher does not free you as a saint from the responsibility of doing what you can to teach your neighbors and whatever friend or acquaintance you can find the way of the truth. We read there, when the early church was scattered abroad in Acts 8 and verse 4, the disciples went everywhere preaching the word. The disciples, they did it. And sometimes we perhaps might have the idea that we have elders. So we don't need to think about the church. We don't need to pray about the church. We don't need to work. We don't need to do anything because we have elders. Well, I think all of you agree with me that we don't want to have that attitude. And when we have deacons, that doesn't mean, oh, we have deacons to do the work. Well, there's work for everybody. There are good deeds that can be done. And so we have to consider these other principles, such as the care of one another's needs falls first and foremost upon the family of that person. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8, if any man provideth not for his own, and especially they of his own household, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever, or worse than an infidel. So this needs to be understood, it needs to be recognized, it needs to be accepted and taken on in family groups, when there are family groups. I'll address that in a moment. And every man needs to do everything he can to provide for his own. Notice this statement in 1 Timothy 5 also, 1 Timothy 5:16. If any woman that believeth hath widows, let her relieve them, and let not the church be burdened, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. Now these are Bible, not only are these Bible principles, these are also really common sense principles, you might say. So, if any woman that believeth hath widows, let her relieve them, and let not the church be burdened, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. I remember a story about a woman in the Old Testament. Her name is Ruth. And Ruth came back with her mother-in-law from Moab. And when they got back to Bethlehem, they didn't have any means of support. So you know what Ruth did? She went out and worked. She went out and gleaned. She gleaned in the fields of Boaz. And she supported herself and her mother-in-law, Naomi. When anyone has a family, that family should look after the person and not the church. There are, however, widows indeed. This is an expression used in 1 Timothy 5. Widows indeed, meaning widows that for one reason or another has no one else to help. Nor do they have the financial means to support themselves or to provide the things that they need. And sometimes one might be a widow indeed because there simply is no family, but one might also be a widow indeed because there is no family that will do what needs to be done. That could also be the case. In cases such as these, as we see in 1 Timothy 5, in the case of the widows indeed, it is work that the church needs to see after. Widows indeed, widows that have no recourse otherwise. As part of the oversight of the elders, it is necessary to try to make sure that neglect does not occur. And deacons may be a part of this effort, certainly. But when a person is able to afford their own support, or when they have family to look after them, then the deacons should not be the primary ones to provide the care, nor should they be expected to be the ones to provide the care in that case. There are times when, because of emergencies that arise, saints in general may need help. Not just widows indeed or something like that, but the saints in general may need help, as was the case in Acts 6 as was the case in Acts 11, verses 27 through 30, when there were the needy saints in Judea, and the money was taken up by the church at Antioch, sent down to the churches of Judea by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. They took it to the elders of those churches. Also, in the collection that Paul took up for the poor saints that were in Jerusalem. So, again, these are times emergencies arise. Saints in general may need help. Not just widows in need, but saints in general because of something that has happened. And in administering such help, the deacons may serve. But we must remember also that in the functioning of a church, the membership in general has a responsibility as well. You see, we can't turn over and say, we're turning over the doing of all good deeds to these certain men that have been appointed. We're turning over the good deeds. Therefore, I don't have to worry about doing any good deeds. I have the good deeds covered, see? No, I'm a Christian. And I need to be concerned about what kind of good deeds am I doing? What kind of opportunities am I having? In Galatians 6 and verse 10, do good unto all men. So then as you have opportunity, do good unto all men, especially them that are of the household of faith. These are responsibilities that fall upon all of us. And so we behold the work done by the saints in Jerusalem in Acts 4 through 6. Do you observe that in those chapters the work was done by the saints in Jerusalem? We are told about Barnabas, Joseph, surnamed Barnabas, who sold a possession, brought the money, laid it at the apostles' feet. And we read about many brethren during that time. They were working hard. So the saints should not have the idea that their work can be done representatively through a select few men. All of the saints have the responsibility to do good unto all men, especially to them that are of the household of faith. It is important to have the contribution that each joint or part supplies for the proper functioning of the church. That comes from Ephesians chapter 4, where he talks about the functioning of the church according to the working in due measure of each several part. And he talks about through that which every joint supplieth. Now, years ago, when I would read every joint supplieth, I would think, now, how does a joint supply anything? I was thinking about an elbow joint. You know, not much flows through an elbow joint. But then it occurred to me that joint has another meaning. A joint or a section of pipe. So every joint, every piece of the pipe, does its part in the good flowing through it. And it is important to have the contribution that each joint or part supplies for the proper functioning of the church. Not only must we have the work that elders do and deacons, but also the work that each member does as opportunity rises. Though the deacons often act in service to the saints, nevertheless, they are not the saints' servants, but they are the elders' assistants. And I think that that is an important distinction that needs to be observed as we have these men working among us. And another thing, I would like to encourage everybody to remember that is a tremendous load that is carried when you are working as an elder, as a deacon, when you work as a preacher of the gospel, trying to do your job. And one of the hardest things to bear is when you're trying to do your very best and you are criticized and you are attacked. And that's extremely difficult. So as a church, let us work together to understand what our elders, what our deacons do, what we are to do as a church, and do everything that we can to help them and encourage them. Each of us needs to be willing to look to the things of others. In other words, to be ready to help when it is needed. Philippians chapter 2 is where that passage is found. Looking each of you not to his own things, but each of you also to the things of others. Now in that passage, that is talking about with the idea to see a need that I can help with, that is not a passage that means I'm going to see after everybody's business. We don't need anybody seeing after everybody's business. But what we do need is to know each other, to be aware of each other, and to be ready to step in and help if there is a problem. Instead of being so focused, you know, on me and mine and what's happening to me, that then I'm not aware of what's happening to other people. It's easy to do that. It's easy to get so focused on what you're doing and so on that you just don't have that time to look to others. Well, we need to try our very best to overcome that. So this is not just the deacon's work. And I think that's the end of the slides. I really appreciate your listening carefully. And I appreciate this church. And I want this church to remain a good church and a strong church and a sound church, because as I go to places and I see the work that is being done because this church exists, I look among us and I see those that have been baptized. I see those people who are new among us, and I want those people to grow. I want them to be encouraged and I want them to grow. And when I go to a Sudbury and find the people there just on fire, trying to do everything they can to build the Lord's work up, the places that I do go and I find people that we have a hand in supporting. And we get these reports. And we think about these preachers in a lot of the places in the world. Souls are being saved. You know what I hope? And see if you can join me with me in this hope. I hope that in heaven, someday, somebody will come up to you and say, "You're from Eastside." Of course, this is not literally going to happen, but it's a point I'm making. Somebody will come up and say, "You're from Eastside. I would never have heard the gospel if it hadn't been for the work that you people did." Wouldn't that make you feel good? And I hope I'll have someone come up to me and say, "Because of a sermon you preached, I became a Christian." That would mean we had a part. Somebody will be in heaven because of what we've done. And that's the way it ought to be. If you're not a Christian tonight, we plead with you to become one. And become a part of this body. Become a part of this work. Believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Repent of your sins. Confess your faith. Be baptized to have your sins forgiven. Become a child of God, a real one, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile, as Jesus said of Nathanael. If you're a child of God, but you've been unfaithful, get your life straightened out. Get it right, so that once again, heaven will be the promise that you can enjoy. If we can help you in either of these ways, we invite you to come as we stand and sing. All right.